morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live for a half hour each weekday morning to take your calls, primarily for those who have questions about the Bible and the Christian faith or who have a difference of opinion from the host and would like to express that here. You're welcome to do so. The number to call is 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. And before we go to the phones, I would like to announce for those who are listening in Southern California that this Saturday I will again be speaking in a home. Actually, not so much speaking as dialoguing. It's like this radio show where it's back and forth. It's an open Bible discussion in a home in Orange County. So if you're listening in Orange County or nearby, consider joining us this Saturday in Lake Forest, California. Now, this meeting begins in the afternoon, Saturday afternoon at 4. It is followed by a potluck meal, which you may participate in or not, as you prefer. And usually it's done by about 7, so you still have your evening free. If you're interested in this gathering, it's this Saturday afternoon in Lake Forest, and you can find information at our website, which is thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com, and go to the link that says announcements. That's where you'll find the information you need. Let's talk to Tom from Colorado today. Tom, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, Steve. First of all, I'd like to tell you that I have listened to your eschatology teachings in the topical lectures on your website about two-thirds through, and I find those fascinating, so thank you for those.
My question is
about the Sabbath as a day of worship. I know we acknowledge that we're not under the law today. We also know that by not following the commandments that we are sinning. So with the tablets and the laws written on our hearts, we follow the law as an obedience to God. And, my understanding is that the Catholic Church changed the Sabbath to Sunday around 538 A.D. And I think the Old Testament's clear on the importance of the Sabbath, but I think Jesus was also clear. And I believe the disciples, all through Acts, honored the Sabbath for worship. So my question is, do you see a problem with this blatant error of worshiping on a Sunday based on a doctrine of the Catholic Church? I mean, even when Christ was crucified, he died on Friday, he rested on Saturday, and he arose again on Sunday. And so I'm just questioning, I'd like to have your opinion on that, please.
Sure. First of all, I think you're correct that it was the Roman Catholic Church which, rather late, that is centuries after the time of Christ, declared that Sunday was the Sabbath. And I don't think that the early Christians ever believed that Sunday was the Sabbath. However, there were earlier Christians that were meeting on Sunday, though they weren't calling it the Sabbath. According to Justin Martyr in the second century, he said the custom of the Christians was to gather on the first day of the week, Sunday, and to hold their meetings there. So Sunday was a time of worship for the early Christians as early as the second century, if not earlier, and yet they weren't calling it the Sabbath. Now, you're right. You made some points. You said the Old Testament is very clear about the importance of the Sabbath. I'll certainly agree with you on that. You said that Jesus reaffirmed that. I'm not so sure that I find that in the teaching of Jesus. And then you mentioned the early church in Acts choosing the Sabbath for the day of worship. I don't necessarily find that to be stated either. I do find that in both the Gospels and the book of Acts, Jesus and the apostles customarily went to the synagogue on the Sabbath day to preach. Of course, that's not exactly the same thing as keeping the Sabbath law, since there was nothing in the Sabbath law that required synagogue worship. That was something that developed during the Babylonian exile, was the synagogue. And we don't read that they were observing the Sabbath in the sense of abstaining from work and all of that. We read that they were preaching in the synagogue. And the other days of the week, they preached wherever else they found people. Like Paul would preach at Mars Hill in Athens, which would not suggest that he was observing the Greek philosophical religious system, but rather that he was trying to invade it and present the gospel there. I think that's what Paul did in the synagogues, and that's what Jesus did in the synagogues. He was trying to present the message of the kingdom. And he did that on the Sabbath, because that's where the people were on the Sabbath. But on the other days of the week, he did it on the hillsides and on in the streets and wherever people would accommodate him. So I'm not sure that we really do find an assertion of the obligation to keep the Sabbath in the teaching of Jesus or the practice of Jesus. It seems like Jesus, in fact, was continually having conflicts with the Jewish teachers because they felt that he wasn't observing the Sabbath. And it's interesting because when they said that, you know, many times Christians will say, well, Jesus really was observing the Sabbath. What he was violating was the Jewish traditions about the Sabbath. But that's not the answer he gave. You know, when they said he was violating the Sabbath, he actually never denied it. He said, well, David violated the law of the showbread, and he's considered blameless. And he said the priests in the temple, they violate the Sabbath, but they're blameless. In other words, instead of saying that he wasn't violating the Sabbath, he indicated that he was not that much different than David or the priests who violated the Sabbath on a regular basis, the priest did. And on one occasion, when they accused him of working on the Sabbath, he said, well, that's because my father works on the Sabbath, and I do too. So, in other words, we don't find Jesus arguing that he was not violating the Sabbath. He argued that he had the right to do so because he was the Lord of the Sabbath.
I guess my question, if I could be just a little bit more specific, I know that they taught every opportunity that they had, both Jesus and the disciples. But as far as worship itself, I mean, the Sabbath was a time set aside for us as followers to worship our God. Is there any difference in being a little more specific on the worship, not so much as honoring the Sabbath as it was in the Old Testament?
Well, that's just it. I don't really find any reference to keeping the Sabbath any other way than in the Old Testament sense. That is, the Old Testament law was that you can do no normal work on the Sabbath day. And there's nothing else that defines the Sabbath otherwise. You know, the Sabbath, if Sabbath is observed, it is observed by ceasing from work. In fact, the word Sabbath means a cessation from work. So we either cease from work or we don't keep the Sabbath. Now, the question is, you know, do we have any particular evidence in the New Testament that Jesus or the apostles ceased from their normal work on the Sabbath? I don't find that they did. Now, as far as of course, their work was preaching, and they preached on the Sabbath as well as every other day. But the normal Christians who were not preachers in the early church, they met for worship, it would seem, or for the things that we refer to as, you know, Christian meetings and so forth. They did that daily. In Acts chapter 2, it said that they continued daily with one accord in the temple and breaking bread and from house to house. They ate their food with simplicity and gladness and so forth. And it says they were continuing steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine and fellowship, breaking of bread and prayers. You know, sitting under the teaching of the apostles, fellowshipping together, breaking bread, that would be apparently taking communion, and praying. This sounds like a worship gathering. And we're told they did this every day in Acts 2:46. So I don't really see in the book of Acts ever that we have a reference to the Christians gathering on the Sabbath as a special day. Now, in Romans chapter 14, Paul said that in Rome there were Christians who observed one day above another. And he said there were other Christians who just esteemed every day alike. And it would seem that in Acts 2:46 that they esteemed every day alike. That is, every day was a day of worship to God. And when Paul noted in Romans 14:5 that there were two different practices among the Christians in Rome, one was people, you know, setting aside a special day for worship, and the other was treating every day alike as a day of worship, Paul said, let everyone be fully persuaded in his own mind. So Paul didn't seem to think there was one of those practices that had to be enforced on everybody, but that instead there was, you know, freedom.
In other words,
Paul didn't seem to think we were
under the law. My understanding on history is that the Sabbath was still honored up until Constantine had pretty much given the authority over to the papacy to be the power that they started to receive. And that
the papacy really didn't exist in the time of Constantine. The papacy, most church historians would place beginning around the year 600 with Pope Gregory the Great. Before that, of course, there were bishops of Rome, as there have been from the time of the apostles, but the bishop of Rome was not didn't have authority over the other bishops, as he later came to in the Roman Catholic system.
My understanding was that Constantine had changed Saturday to Sunday, and then the Catholic Church just adapted that when they were in power. For pagan reasons.
Yeah, I'm not sure that you're wrong. You might be right about that, that Constantine may have made Sunday an official day of worship. What I'm saying, though, is that two centuries before Constantine, Justin Martyr said that was the ordinary practice of the Christians in his days to worship on Sunday. So, there may have been some of the Jewish believers who continued to worship on the Sabbath. But it would seem that in Gentile lands, from early times, they didn't necessarily observe Saturday as a Sabbath as a day of worship. Now, they did, in the book of Acts, you do find the word Sabbath used quite a bit, and it's always used about Saturday. But that's because it's always talked about on the Sabbath day, Paul went into the synagogue to preach. But what we don't find is any statement in the book of Acts that says that the early Christians observed the Jewish Sabbath. And in fact, we don't really have any statement in the Gospels to say that Jesus observed it.
Okay, well, I appreciate your clarity on that, and thank you very much.
Okay, Tom, I appreciate your call. And if any Christians who are listening here feel they must keep the Sabbath, I would advise the same thing Paul advised: let everyone be fully persuaded in his own mind. That's what you feel in your conscience you should do, then I certainly wouldn't wish to discourage it. Let's talk next to Marie from Huntington Beach. Hi, Marie. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, and I so want to hang up. I don't really want to talk about this, but I became a Christian 30 years ago, and I seem to be like ripped hot, on fire for the Lord, or else like bitter. And not like God who, and just go on with my life, not necessarily falling into any outward sin, but just a coldness, as to what is truth, what is real. So I don't know if the whole thing is like in other words, when I take it from my head to my heart, when I really sit quiet, what do I believe? I just feel like my heart is aching.
Yeah, so when you say bitterness, you mean bitterness toward God, not bitterness toward anyone in particular?
I mean, I could name, there's not any big issue, but so I guess it is towards God. I don't know. It's like there's a lot of vagueness.
Are there any specific smaller issues that come to your mind, or is it hard even to think of anything specific?
I think it's trust. Like in my family of origin, it was very much outward, you know, do this, do that, and I always felt so, I was very fear-based. And then when I came to the Lord, it was this overwhelming love that I had for Him because He loved me. And when I don't sense that love, I just get, I think I panic and just harden my heart and just, I don't know what I believe.
Okay, so there's times when you have felt God's love for you, and there's times when
incredibly. And at those times, I'm just so passionately in love with Him. And then when I don't sense that love, when it becomes to like your last caller, like the thing about the Sabbath and this and that, I think, who cares? I just want to know I'm loved.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're about normal in that respect. That in the respect that sometimes we feel the warmth of God's acceptance and of God's love, and sometimes we don't feel anything at all. I think if we base our relationship with God on our emotional feelings like that, we are going to have ups and downs, of course. Of course, that's true even if you base your... Are you a married woman?
No, not anymore.
I see. Well... you used to be, so picture yourself as a married person for the sake of this illustration. When you enter into a marriage, you have a husband, and sometimes you feel his love towards you, and sometimes you don't. But if it's not he who's changing, but it's simply your feelings that are changing, mm-hmm. you just realize that happens in a relationship. Sometimes you're feeling good about it. Sometimes you're not feeling so good. Either you're distracted, or it might be that time of the month, or some other thing can make a person mm-hmm. not feel what they feel at other times. But the objective reality of the marriage is that you've got a husband who's made a vow to you, who's keeping his vows to you, and who... says he loves you and so forth, and sometimes you'll feel that more than others. It may be at times you feel it less at certain times because he's preoccupied, because he's busy or something, and he's not showing much affection, but there may be times when he is showing affection and you're just not inwardly, you're just not there and you're not feeling it. In other words, people's emotions go up and down, sometimes inexplicably. And the same is true with the relationship with God. The question you have to ask yourself when you're not feeling God's love is, do I still have evidence that God loves me? Because there's going to be times when I feel it and times I don't. But I can't just have a policy of believing it when I feel it and doubting it when I don't feel it. Because we simply can't live primarily from
right.
our emotions.
Okay.
Our emotions change
to unpredictable. I'm following you, but what seems to happen is my head goes like, it's this constant chatter of what I'm trying to analyze. And how do you come to the point where you don't listen to your head?
Well, you have to listen to your head, but you can't always believe everything it says. You have to analyze what comes to your head. And judge it. You know, Paul said, judge all things, or prove all things, and hold fast to what is good. Our heads are going to be hearing all kinds of messages. Some of them are going to be generated from within ourselves. Others are going to come to us from other people talking or other things we read. And we have to continually be discerning the validity or lack thereof of the messages we're hearing. You know, when I was young, when I was in my teens, there were times when I had moments where I wondered, you know, about the truthfulness of, you know, whether God loved me or not. And because I didn't always feel it, I'm not a highly emotional person, though I have emotions, and sometimes I feel it and sometimes I don't. But, you know, whenever I had a lack in the emotional realm, I just asked myself, is it still objectively true that God sent his son because he loved me and died for me? If Jesus died for me, greater love has no one than this, than that they will lay down their life for a friend. And therefore, unless that history can be changed, then I have to believe God loves me. Now, I don't think history can be changed. You can't change the past. Jesus literally did come to earth because he loved the world, because God loved the world, and I'm part of the world, so he loved me. And he gave his son for me, and he died for me. And that is true. No matter how I feel about it any given day, it's historically true, and it is God's way of saying, listen, you know, whatever you may be feeling today, what I did 2,000 years ago is the proof that I love you, and I don't change like you do, you know. God doesn't, you know, our emotions go all over the place, and some people have more volatile emotional ups and downs than others do. But all of us have times when we're just not feeling something. We don't feel for our spouse what we once felt. We don't feel toward mm-hmm. our children the mm-hmm. way we normally want to feel toward them, mm-hmm. Or toward our friends, mm-hmm. or toward God. But that's mm-hmm. because we are volatile creatures. But God isn't volatile. God, yeah, he doesn't change.
Yeah.
And therefore, when the feelings, you know, are not there, which feelings make me think God loves me, I have to use my mind. I have to realize that, well, the facts remain the same. You know, God is still.
Yeah, I think what's happening is that I'm putting my emotional makeup onto God, thinking that He's fickle like I am. I mean, with on a subliminal level, yeah, okay.
It's possible. Yeah, it's very possible because we're all over the place emotionally, but God isn't all over the place emotionally. God is steady.
Right.
God is faithful.
Right.
And therefore,
right.
at those times when the feeling of God's love is absent, then the fact of His love has got to be counted on until the time comes when we're feeling it again. Feelings will come
right.
and go.
Okay. Yeah, that helps. Okay. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Okay, Marie. Thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
We'll talk again, hopefully. Okay, let's talk to Jesse from Denver, Colorado next. Jesse, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
How you doing, brother?
I'm fine. Thank you.
Okay. My question is on the speaking in tongues. I'm sort of confused because I read in the book of 1 and 2 Corinthians. I can't remember if it was Peter or the one who was talking in there. He said, you know, you probably know somewhat about it, is if people are all speaking in tongues and somebody comes into the church or where they're speaking, they would probably think this place is crazy or they're lunatics. So
That's 1 Corinthians 14:23.
Okay. And the bottom line was when Peter said, if you're going to speak to God and not confuse, it's just go to your prayer closet, shut the door, and speak to God. That's my understanding. Well, that's the way I take it. And a lot of people will say, well, we'll set up interpreters and people that will, you know, they're supposed to do it in a decent manner, a decent way when they're talking in tongues and somebody else. But when you're talking, when you're praying to God, what about what Peter said? Just shut the door and speak to God.
Yeah. Actually, it's not Peter who spoke about that. I think you're quoting Jesus from the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus said, when you pray, go into your closet and shut the door. That's in Matthew 6. In 1 Corinthians 14, where Paul's giving directions about speaking in tongues, he says that speaking in tongues can edify the church if it is accompanied with an interpretation.
Yeah.
So a genuine gift of tongues coupled with a genuine interpretation can be edifying and useful, and Paul did not want to prevent that from happening in the church. But he did want to prevent speaking in tongues from taking place in a chaotic way that does not bring glory to God or edification of the church. He didn't want more than one person speaking in tongues at the same time, and he didn't want speaking in tongues going on without an interpretation. Now, you know, you're right. In 1 Corinthians 14:23, Paul said, if an unbeliever comes in and everybody's speaking in tongues, they're going to think you're mad.
Yeah.
And yet that's the same chapter where he said in verse 27, if anyone speaks in a tongue, let it be by two or three, each in turn, and let one interpret. But if there's no interpreter, let him keep silent in the church and let him speak to himself and to God. So you're right. Paul does recommend that if there's no interpreter, people should speak in tongues only privately, apparently in their prayer closet or whatever. So what is it that's confusing to you? Is it that you've been in churches people are going mad speaking in tongues?
If when the apostles spoke in different tongues, they spoke in the proper dialects to the certain people that were there, and they were speaking in different tongues, but they were speaking to people that understood, like Spanish or Japanese or Korean or Vietnamese. They were all speaking in the right way to them.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're thinking about the day of Pentecost, and you're right. On the day of Pentecost, when the Spirit came and all the 120 were speaking in tongues, it would seem, there were at least 15 different language groups present in Jerusalem, and all of them heard them speaking in their own language. So they were apparently speaking in known languages from these different geographical regions. And that's correct on the day of Pentecost. But that was as a sign to the unbelievers on the day of Pentecost, as we see. And Paul himself admits in 1 Corinthians 14, in verse 22 that tongues is assigned to unbelievers. But he also sees tongues, apparently another function of tongues, that is edifying to the church. Now, the church is a gathering of Christians, not unbelievers. And he says that when a person is speaking in tongues in the church, it's not necessarily a known language. In fact, he says in 1 Corinthians 14:2, for he who speaks in a tongue does not speak to men, but to God. So this is praying in tongues, not speaking to human ears. For no one understands him, Paul says. So Paul's talking about speaking in a tongue that no one can understand. It's not a tongue that is a known language to the hearers. This is a different setting than the day of Pentecost. On the day of Pentecost, this was a public sign to the unbelievers. And the sign was that these people could speak to the unbelievers in those languages or speak languages they could understand. But when Paul talks about speaking in tongues in the church, he speaks of speaking a language that nobody present understands, and that's why there needs to be a gift of interpretation. On the day of Pentecost, there was no gift of interpretation. They didn't need it because the people, of course, understood the languages that were being spoken already. I appreciate your call. I'm almost out of time, but I wanted to take another call, if I can, real quickly here. Luke from Aurora, Colorado is next. Welcome.
Yes, thank you for taking my call, Steve. My question is about the Tetragrammaton from the Hebrew, YHWH, the personal name for God.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering about the pronunciation, because you know the Jehovah's Witnesses, they say it's Jehovah.
Well, they pronounce it Jehovah. A lot of scholars say it should be pronounced more like Yahweh. It's not really important, because we don't have to say the name, although some people would like for us to. But the Jews, I think they refer to it as the unpronounceable name of God, not because it really can't be pronounced, but because it's too sacred to pronounce for them. And it could be pronounced with a J sound at the beginning or with a Y sound at the beginning, depending on how one vocalizes the Hebrew. But we can't really settle it. I don't think even scholars can settle it completely, though most would pronounce it Yahweh or something like that. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We're a listener-supported ministry, and you can find out more about that at our website, thenarrowpath.com. We've had quite a few calls from Colorado today. I'll be speaking in Colorado in Centennial in the middle of April. Check that out at our website, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us.